In Revelation chapter 20, we see what I call the culmination of history. It's the end. It's what we do when we go to the Feast of Tabernacles and come into the last great day. It's this concept of finality. It is the Satan is once again released from his prison that he had been in for 1,000 years during the millennial reign. And he is loosed and he goes out, and it says in verse 7 and verse 8 and coming down to verse 9, and he gathers together with him an army. An army that is called Gog and Magog. I don't know if you ever heard a sermon before on the subject of Gog and Magog. It was kind of a first, but it's often, I think, something that's overlooked, because when we read the scripture and then we see Satan is cast into the lake of fire with the beast and the false prophet, Satan's not the only thing destroyed there. This army that he gathers, which is called Gog and Magog, is also destroyed, and that's important because they have served a purpose in history going all the way back to the times of the kings, to the nations of Judah and the nation of Israel. Going all the way back. We don't often think about that, but this has been a subject I've thought about it for a long time, and I find very fascinating, because their destruction with Satan here in Revelation chapter 20 is also very important, and it serves a purpose that we can look forward to, because Gog and Magog has always existed, and they've existed for one main purpose, so that the nations will know that I am the Lord. That has been the purpose of this army that we read about in Revelation chapter 20, this great horde that gathers together with Satan, but they have always served a purpose so that the nations will know that I am the Lord. And we do this going all the way back. What I would like to do today is go through a study of who and what Gog and Magog are and go through how they've shaped history. And we're going to be going through the reason I put together a presentation is because we're going to be going through dates and times and a historical timeline to make it a little bit easier for you. But we're going to go through who and what Gog and Magog are and how they've shaped history, and a history that we all know. Two, we're going to look at how they point to God. How do they serve the purpose of understanding and helping us to understand who God is? And thirdly, we're going to see why they are lumped in with Satan and needing to be destroyed in the end time. So let's go back to the very beginning. You see here I've kind of put together a timeline, but if we go back all the way and we look at the subject of who these people are, the idea of who Gog and Magog are is not really a big mystery. If you read United Church of God's literature, and honestly, even if you were to look into a lot of evangelical literature, you'd see we typically identify Gog and Magog as this confederation of Russia and China, if you would read kind of our U.S. and B.C. and prophecy type materials. And that's all correct. I don't disagree with that, but there's a caveat to it. The idea of Russia and China is a modern construct. China, to some degree, has existed for a long period of time. Russia, really, in the form that we know it, has not. What Gog and Magog really is, this horde army from what is typically considered from the north and from the east, from the Holy Land, really refers to what we call the people of the steppe. Steppe being S-T-E-P-P-E. This region you see here in green that is Central Europe, Central Asia, this large swath of grassland. It is kind of lowland grassland from Hungary, Romania, through the Balkans, up through the Ural Mountains into Russia, across over into Mongolia and to portions of China. For centuries, going all the way back, this has been a land where groups of people have lived here that we would almost equate to like the pre-colonial Indians, the prairie Indians that lived kind of west from here. These were people that we called, a steppe nomad tribes. They were migratory. They lived basically on the back of a horse. They were people that traveled throughout this region, and they didn't really build cities because this land is terrible to live in. And so those that adapted and learned to live in this land had to become mobile. They didn't build cities because they had to move around with their horses to find food. They didn't cultivate the land. They didn't build farms because the land wasn't worth it for that. They primarily only ate milk and meat because they couldn't grow very many crops. This territory is very brutally cold, and when the summer comes, it's brutally hot with wind conditions. And from the earliest stages of people that we see living in this region, they primarily lived in what are called yurts, which is kind of a felt tent that they could break down, put on their backs and put on the back of their horses and move to where they could find new food for their animals. And from the very beginning, these people would live this way up until about the mid-1800s without very little change. It wouldn't really be until the modern concepts of both gunpowder, combining with the idea of electricity and some of the modern amenities, would people from this region really change how they lived. But from the earliest signs, and we can find trace their histories back till the times of Judah and Israel, up until about the mid-1800s, the people of this region really didn't change how they lived. They were so well adapted to their societies, that's what they became. The people of this region were usually, you know, they weren't large groups of cities, and so they were nomadic people. But every once in a while, they would coalesce into larger armies and larger groups. And when that would happen, they'd usually sweep down. But they were primarily known for two things. The people of this region, as I mentioned, were horse people. They began learning to ride a horse oftentimes before they learned to walk. Their children, less than a year of one, would be put on a horse and start to training it. They would grow up on the horse. They were the first people to develop the horse as an animal to ride. Because horses, when they're original, and when you go back through history, you realize first came the chariot, which they also created, because a chariot could pull. And the horses were much smaller, and when they go back, they had to be bred to become larger so that people could ride them on their backs. They were the first to have a chariot. They were the first to ride a horse. And in doing so, they became like at one with these animals, and they could ride them faster than everybody else. They were experts on that. You think of the idea of Annie Oakley and these people, you know, these trick horse people that we ride. Their entire society was that type of horse rider. The horse and the person became as one because they would ride together for the entire time. The second thing they were greatly known for, no matter which tribe you ran into, is they were experts with a bow. Their bow was larger than anybody else's on the scene. It would take 10 years to learn to draw it because it was so heavy. They would have to pull so hard, they'd have to develop the strength. Their bows could shoot the length of 5 football fields with a level of accuracy. They could ride a horse at full speed, firing over 10 arrows per minute, oftentimes slung off to the side, shooting up underneath the neck of the horse, and they could hit a target about this big 10 times out of 10. They were experts. There is nobody throughout history and time has ever been anything like them, and they were the greatest warriors in some regards that you can think about that has ever existed, and they existed for a long period of time. But there's a concept in history that history is written by the victors, isn't it? That's how we know. Those who win are the ones who write down the stories. But what if one of the greatest armies and groups of people throughout all of mankind in history never wrote anything down? Because like I said, these were nomadic people. They didn't have schools. They didn't have libraries. The concept of education meant nothing to them. They didn't write down stories of their conquests. They had a slight oral tradition, if you will, but they don't really write it much down. And so what we know about them comes from their dealings with those that they would run into. Because when they would coalesce into a larger group and sweep down to land, they were usually very destructive. These armies were horrendously powerful. They were mean. They were cruel. These people would scar their faces from a young age to make themselves. They would tattoo themselves. They would use illicit drug use and alcohol that they would make out of goat's milk. These were not nice people at all. They were a cruel, intense people. And when you ran into them in battle, you rarely lived to write the tale afterwards. And so we have very little histories of them because they weren't writing much as well. But we do know. We do know a little bit about them. And if we think back, we've heard of it too. Because if you see on that eastern edge as it goes over till China, from the very early stage, one of these confederations, a people called the Xiongnu, were very involved in Chinese society at that time, picking around the edges. And for a period of time, they invaded into China and actually destroyed and were taking over part of it. They were eventually kicked out, and then the Chinese built something that we can still see today to keep them from coming back. It was the Great Wall of China. That still to this day stands as a monument, and their desire to create a border that ran the length of their region to keep these horse people out. The Greeks in their society tell the story of a mythological creature called the centaur. The centaur was half man, he's half horse, and he carried a bow. And he came out of this dealings that these Greek people would deal with these people in their northern borders who came out of the same region of the steppe lands. The concept of the Amazonian princess, this mythical warrior princesses of society of women who were expert fighters and stronger as men, that was, once again, another nomadic people out of this region of the steppe whose women were the primary fighters. And there's stories of this society where their women couldn't get married until they had bested a man in battle. So we see rumors. We see the edges. We see how these people would come into contact with them. But we don't get a lot because very rarely, when you did come into contact with them, very rarely would you survive. And so these people sat on the side, and every once in a while they would coalesce together, and they would sweep in and cause utter destruction. And then they would leave and retreat back into this land that nobody else dared go into because very few people could survive up there. In Daniel chapter 2, Daniel interprets a dream that is given to King Nebuchadnezzar. That Nebuchadnezzar asks for his interpretation, and God giving Daniel this power gets a vision of a statue with a head of gold, with a body of silver, a torso of bronze, legs of iron, and feet of iron and clay mixed together. And Daniel, through God giving him the inspiration, tells him, you know, great king, what you are seeing is this head of gold is you. You are Babylon. You will be the first empire in a string of great empires that will come over this period of time, followed by the Persians, down to the Greek Empire, to the Romans, down to the feet mixed with iron and clay, which will be last, kind of showing going forward. And then Christ coming down and says there's a stone that will break break it at the end. But he's given this prophecy of what time will be and showing what is going to be with you, great King Nebuchadnezzar, as the first that will start. But there will be a string of great empires over a long period of time that will take over. The purpose of this prophecy here in Daniel, I believe, has three reasons. One, God is showing everybody here that he is in control of history. God is the one who's in control of history. He determines the timing and the course of nations, when they will rise up and when they will decline. And he sets the boundaries of the nations, he sets up rulers, and he removes the rulers in accordance with his plan and with his purpose. He is in control. He will set up who he wills, and he will take them down in their due course. The second thing he's telling these people is he's telling the nation of Israel and the people of Judah here, who had recently been captured and taken into captivity by these people, and he wanted them to know that their existence was not in vain. There was still a purpose for them. They had a role to play in the first coming of Christ, and they will have a key role to play in the second coming of Christ, and God was not done with Israel or with Judah. And he's telling them how he is going to be able to set the course of history for that. The third thing that we learn from this prophecy is judgment is in God's hands, and he will not hesitate to execute it in his righteousness. Gog and Magog, as we will see, will become one of his main instruments to finally eradicate sin and rebellion from his presence, and that this army would be a means by which he would mete out his justice on the world. Because we know about these great empires, don't we? Everybody knows about Babylon, about Persia, especially the Greeks and the Romans. There's so much material about all of them. But they didn't exist in a vacuum. And they didn't just rise up and fall down under their own power all the time. Because for them to exist, there had to be a counterforce. There had to be someone else that would help create it. In 606, I'm sorry if you can't see the dates too well on this monitor here, but in 606, when this prophecy in Daniel is written, Babylon is set up as the great empire. Nebuchadnezzar is the king. But Babylon could not become the great empire that it was without first Assyria going off the map. Because for decades and years before this, Assyria was the greatest empire. And Assyria was the ones that took the northern nation of Israel into captivity and destroyed them. And Assyria was this brutal army that was merciless, that would ravage the land. And Babylon was never quite strong enough to defeat them and take their place in the course of history in this, until an army came down from that region of the steppe, one of these Gog and Magog armies. And in 613, just 7 years before this prophecy of Daniel 2, where Babylon is established in their greatness, in 613, just 7 years before, an army called the Scythians, which were a steppe nomadic people who swept down from the northern region, came down and destroyed the Assyrian Empire. They laid waste to the city of Nineveh. They laid waste to a lot of their other large cities, so much so that 200 years after that point, a Greek raiding party would be coming through this region in the land of the Tigris River, and they would come upon a massive city of stone sit in the middle of the desert that is completely deserted. Nobody was there. And they stood upon it, and they looked, and they said, who is this? Who built this great city, which was larger than anything they had in their day 200 years later, not even knowing the Assyrians had ever existed? The Assyrians were destroyed utterly. In 1925, historian Sidney Smith wrote a book where he said, quote, "The disappearance of the Assyrian people will always remain a unique and striking phenomenon in ancient history. Other similar kingdoms and empires have indeed passed away, but the people have lived on. No other land seems to have been sacked and pillaged so completely as Assyria." Assyria was destroyed utterly. Their cities were destroyed. Their people were destroyed when this army swept in and wiped them out. So much so that really, if you look through the historical record, it wasn't until the mid-1900s when we started finding and excavating some of these cities and discovering this concept of who Assyria was that had been written about in the Bible. There was a long period of time in history where people thought that was not a real group of people that existed. They were destroyed completely. In 1 Samuel 15, if you'll go there, we see this concept of utter destruction. In 1 Samuel 15, we find King Saul is given some instructions. 1 Samuel 15, and let's read in verse 2. It says, "Thus says the Lord of hosts, I will punish Amalek for what he did to Israel, how he ambushed him in the way when he came up from Egypt. Now go and attack, and he's talking to Saul, go and attack the Amalek and utterly destroy all that they have, and do not spare them, but kill both man and woman, infant and nursing child, ox, sheep, camel, and donkey. If we go down to verse 9, it says, Saul and the people go and they attack as they are told, but they don't follow the directions that God had given them. Because in verse 9 it says, and Saul and the people spared Agag, who was the king of the Amalekites, and the best of the sheep and the oxen, and the fatlings and the lambs, and all that was good, and were unwilling to utterly destroy them. But everything despised and worthless they utterly destroyed. They kept some bounty. They kept those things that they wanted for themselves. Verse 10 says, now the word of the Lord came to Samuel, saying, I will regret that I have set up Saul as king, for he was turned back from following me and has not performed my commandments, and has grieved Samuel that he cried out to the Lord all night. Saul disobeyed God when he told him, these are people I have deemed unworthy. These are people who have come against my people. I have judged them, and you will be my instrument to destroy them. And he wanted them gone completely. Now, Saul didn't do it. He left the king alive. He took some of the animals and those, and he disobeyed God so much so that God is now sorry that he made Saul king. If we go over to verse 18, he tells us of Samuel, and he tells Samuel to go and confront Saul. And verse 18 says, now the Lord sent you a mission. He said, go and utterly destroy the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they are consumed. Why then did you not obey the voice of the Lord? Why did you swoop down on the spoil and done evil in the sight of the Lord? Saul was judged for not following God's way of life. It was established here, if you will, that these people were not worthy to be this agents of destruction that were needed, because when God judged the Amalekites to be so wrong, he wanted them completely wiped out. Well, we know Assyria were not good people. We know that there are prophecies against them, and so when God finally brought his judgment upon them, he had to go grab a different group of people. He grabbed these people from the north, these people of the steppe, these armies of Gog and Magog, and when they came in, they followed this principle to a T. They destroyed everything. Men, women, children, animals, everything. And they would serve this purpose as an agent of God's destruction to come down, and when he judged Assyria, they would be destroyed. And when Assyria falls, now Babylon is set up that they can become the new king and the new great nation that God has deemed. And so we have, it was the people from the north coming down and setting the stage so that Babylon could rise. And so in 606, the Babylonian Empire under Nebuchadnezzar is set up. Now the next body of silver that would come along would be that of the Persian Empire. And so for the Persians to come on the scene, they were going to have to first best the Babylons and destroy them. Now Babylon at this time was allied with a lot of these people from the steppe at this point. But as Cyrus, who Jeremiah prophesies about, it would be the king that would rise up, as he begins to become king of the Persian Empire, he's not strong enough on his own to go up against the Babylonians. He first would need to envelop and incorporate these people who are sitting on his northern border, the northern part of what we would call Iran today. And so he has to envelop and take in the people called the Medes, which were a nomadic steppe people from this region here that we're considering Gog and Magog. And so Cyrus goes to battle with their king, whose name was Astyages, and he defeats him in battle and incorporates these people, and they become now the people, the Medes and the Persians, if you will. You know, we read the book of Esther, and that's how they're referred to. Cyrus had to first defeat them in battle and incorporate them into his people. If we go over to Isaiah 3, we see a prophecy about them. And so now Cyrus is strong enough with these people, and he's able to go to battle with Babylon and destroy them. And Isaiah 13 tells about this, because once again, God is involved in setting this stage. Isaiah chapter 13. And verse 1 says, now this is a burden against Babylon, which Isaiah the son of Amoz saw. Dropping down to verse 4, it says, a noise of a multitude in the mountains, like that of many people, a tumultuous noise of the kingdoms of the nations gathered together, the Lord of hosts musters an army for battle. They come from a far country, from the end of heaven, the Lord and his weapons of indignation to destroy the whole land. If we drop down, we'll see here in verse 17, what he's talking about here are the Medes. This people, this northern steppe region, these people of Gog and Magog, but he calls them his weapons of indignation. He musters an army when he is judged. We saw in verse 1, this is a judgment against you, Babylon. You have been an evil people who are not worthy. You'd taken, you know, he brought them up, obviously, for one point to bring Judah and take them into captivity, but now they are being judged, and he will raise up this army of the Medes. And he calls them his weapons of indignation. these people he aims to bring together to mete out justice. Dropping down to verse 17, says, "Behold, I will stir up the Medes against them, who will not regard silver, and as for gold, they will not delight in it. Also their bows will dash the young men to pieces, and they will have no pity on the fruit of the womb. Their eye will not spare the children. And Babylon, the glory of the kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldeans' pride, will be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah." And we know how utter destruction that God meted out on that city back in the day. He calls these people his weapons of indignation, who don't care about gold, who don't care about silver, because what is gold and silver to a person who lives only on a horse and can only carry that which his horse can carry? They didn't care about these things. They would follow this principle that Saul would not do, and they would utterly destroy him. And so these the people, the Medes and the Persians that God tells, and Persia comes in and sweeps in and destroys the city of Babylon. And destroys them, and setting up in 536, the Persian Empire follows through as Daniel chapter 2 told us they would. But they couldn't do it without first bringing in, once again, these armies of the north that would be his weapons of destruction to take down the first. You see, these four incarnations that Daniel 2 tells us about can't just exist. They don't just fall off the scene because they wanted to. They had to first be destroyed. They had to first be judged and taken away. And it becomes upon these weapons of indignation that Isaiah tells us about are the people that would do it. Now, Cyrus is a great king who sets up the Persian Empire and is considered very strongly. Now, he would eventually die chasing after these people to the north, going in and chasing after a people called the Mazagetai up into the northern regions of the steppe lands. And so then his son Cambyses would take over and a couple others. And we'd eventually come down to a descendant named Darius, who is the great king of the Persian Empire. Darius is the one who really sets about the mass expansion and this army that moved around like a blob, just taking over everybody they would. They were a very mighty army in their day, very large. And so Darius is the one that really oversees this great expansion. And at one point he gets in his mind that he's kind of sick of these people to the north, these nomadic steppe people up to the north, always kind of picking at his edges, you know, raiding parties and whatnot. And he says, "I'm the greatest king, I had this great army, I'm going to go up and show them a lesson." And so he moves north. Now, these armies of the steppe were very powerful when they came into your own land and besieged your own cities. Very few people ever really wanted to go into their land and fight them on their home battle, their home turf. Darius makes a crucial mistake in that he decides he will go try to do it. And so he takes his army and he moves north and he invades and goes up and he's chasing them around. But the problem with trying to attack these people is they don't have a city to besiege. They don't have anything to really go after. They are a nomadic people who live on the back of their horse that move around. And so he's taking this large army and extending himself further, and he eventually continues up even into Europe, crossing over into kind of the region of the Balkans, chasing after these people. It's once again the same group, the Scythians that we read about, that took down the Assyrian Empire. And he chases after them, and he's extending his supply lines, and he's getting upset. And the story is accounted in Herodotus, in the Greek historian. And he says that King Darius finally sends a runner to the king of the, his name is Idianthros, of the Scythian people. And he sends up and says, "You know, why are you running away from me? Turn, face me in battle. Why are you so afraid? You know, why do you keep running away?" And Idianthros writes him back, and Herodotus recounts this letter, which I find is very interesting because it gives us a little bit of an insight of who these people are. And so his response, Idianthros back to King Darius of Persia says, "This is the situation, Persian. I have not fled from anyone out of fear before, and I am not fleeing from you now. What I have been doing is, in fact, no different than what I am accustomed to doing in times of peace. I'll tell you why I do not engage you now. It is because we have neither towns nor cultivated land to worry about being captured or razed, which in doing thus would force us to engage you in battle sooner. But if you must really come to battle without further delay, know that we do have ancestral graves. So come on, then, find them, and try to destroy them. You will know whether or not we will fight for our graves. But before that, you should not engage in battle until we see fit to do so." And then he would continue on and say, "Instead of gifts of earth and water," that's what the Persians would ask if they deemed that you should show fealty to them and bow down, you were to give them a gift of earth and water. So Idianthros writes back and says, "Instead of gifts of earth and water, I shall send you the kind of tokens you really merit. And in response to your claim to be my master, I tell you, weep. This is the answer from the Scythians." And King Idianthros sends back five things: a frog, a mouse, a bird, and three arrows. The implication being, unless you can swim like a frog, fly like a bird, burrow like a mouse, then you will die by my arrows. The Scythian king faces down this mighty empire that has the strongest people on the scene and says, I will not deal with you. I'm not afraid of you. I will continue doing what I'm doing. And if you eventually want to face us, you can go after and find our graves, but be gone with you. He brushes him aside like he is no more person that you run into at a grocery store. And so Darius, in a fit, is never able to really track them down, and so he's stuck there, and he goes home. And that, this is the type of scene that you see why no one was able to really go up and ever really engage these people. They could just move. But the problem is, in this scene, we know now the Persians would eventually have to come down, and the Greeks would have to come up. And so now Darius and his great army is sitting north of Greece. And Greeks are seeing there and seeing this mighty army that's sitting above them, and they're very afraid. And they lead to what's called the Ionian Revolt, the Ionian Peninsula being a large portion of where the Greeks are. And that revolt coming up against Darius makes him turn his attention south. And now all of a sudden he sees this great land of the Greeks down below him, one that he had not been really dealing with or worried about at this point, but now they revolted because they were afraid that he's sitting on his north border. And we begin to have these great battles that we know about through history because the Greeks were excellent historians. And so we have the invasion that Darius does upon the people down the Greeks. And then when he dies, his son Xerxes would do the same. These great invasions that we've heard about, the Battle of the 300, the Hot Gates of Thermopylae, where the Spartans held off the invasion of the Persian Empire. The Battle of Salamis, which is this great naval warfare where the Greeks defeat this much larger army. The Battle of Marathon, where the victory, a runner runs 26.2 miles to deliver the news that they have won their battle, and then falls and dies at their feet, giving us the marathon race that we have to this day. We all know about those great battles, but they're set forward and they're set up because Darius takes his army up chasing after these people of the steppe. And when he can't deal with them, we all of a sudden fall upon the Greeks and the Persian empires, fighting it out, eventually leading to the destruction of the Persians at the hands of the Greeks. And so we have the third incarnation, if you will, of Daniel 2 in this prophecy. And we come down to the Greek Empire, as Alexander the Great would rise up and create an even mightier empire as before. So the Persians were greater than the Babylonians. And now the Greeks, under Alexander the Great, would conquer even more regions. They would go and conquer Persia. They would conquer more. Now Alexander and his would move north and try to do the same thing that Darius would try to do and move into the steppe land, and he would also face the same mistake and not be able to do it, and he'd come back south and he'd go off to India because no one was ever really able to go up into their own land and take them on. But Alexander, much as we all know, as a great warrior as he was, dies an early death. He burns white hot for a short period of time, conquers so much at a young age, and in his young 30s, falls and dies. And his empire is broken up into four pieces. His four generals take it over. And this region of the Holy Land that we know about fell under the Seleucid Empire, which was the general Seleucus, which was one of his top four generals, takes over the land of Persia, Babylon, Greece, and all this region. And we have now the Seleucid Greek Empire that rose up. And this is the empire that we read about as we continue on through the book of Daniel. The intertestamental period, you know, the abomination of desolation, or Antiochus Epiphanes, this history that we read about at the end of Daniel, these are the Seleucids. These are the Greeks who would come in and rule this area of the Holy Land. But they too only had, you know, a certain period of time that they could last. And sitting on their edges were another group of these steppe people, these steppe nomads that sat up there, a group of people called the Parthians. And the Parthians would revolt in 245, and they would break free of a region. They would kill King Antiochus II, who was the ruler. But then his son Antiochus III would lead a revolt, take part of it back. But then we come down to 148 B.C., and the Parthians would once again lead a revolt, and they'd conquer the eastern capital of Seleucus, their actual capital city. And they would thus establish what would be called the Parthian Empire, which would have control over Mesopotamia, Babylonia, and this area of the Holy Land. And when they did this, they left only a small portion of the Seleucid Empire that was still intact, that was all the way over on their western border, that would become a buffer for them against the Romans. But then the Romans would sweep in and destroy this little piece, because the Parthians had cut their power down to nothing at this point. And this little vestige of Greek rule over this area of the Holy Land of the Seleucid Empire would then be defeated as the Romans, as they begin their growing in the Republic phase before the coming of Christ, sweep down into this region then and destroy them. And now that would set up what would be called the Roman-Parthian Wars, and there's some very good histories beyond with all that as well, as they would do battle and have difficulties with each other kind of through the area of Mesopotamia. But it is the Romans then who come down and can sweep away this last little vestige of Greek control over this land, thus setting up now the Roman Empire. And the Roman Empire, you know, at this time, and we go through the times of Julius Caesar and Alexander Augustus, you know, Caesar as we come about, and the Roman Empire has really set its stage in 27, and it rules for a long period of time, and it is considered one of the great empires in human history. And it rules for a long, you know, of iron. Their legions were all over the world, you know, Pax Romana, as they set about through North Africa, through the Holy Land, through Europe, controlling much of the known world at that time. But time would come, and they would continue to have many numerous battles on their northern borders, fighting off what were the Germanic tribes of those days, a very fierce people, a people who were afraid of nothing, who were always kind of a thorn in the side of the Romans. And they were always kind of fighting through Germania, through Gaul, through Spain a little bit, and over into kind of the Balkans regions, a people they could never quite do away with. But then we come down to around the time of the 300s A.D., and the Romans are not quite as powerful as they were before, but then a new player comes on the scene, and his name was Attila, and he was called a Hun. Attila the Hun comes sweeping in through Romania, through Hungary, which is named after his people, and sweeps in and begins to fight these Germans on the eastern border. And these Germans who had put off the Romans for decades and centuries now are being wiped out. First, Attila would come in and destroy a group of Germanic people called the Alans. Then he would destroy the Ostrogoths, and they would go to battle with the Visigoths. And these people who had fought off the Romans for so long now are afraid. They had never been afraid before. But these fearsome people who came in from the east, these people they didn't know about, this Attila the Hun and his armies, come sweeping in and knock them aside, these strong, powerful people, like they're nothing. And they're scarred and they're disfigured. They thought they were aliens because these people would cut their faces before puberty so that they didn't like beards. So they would cut their faces so much they would scar it, so they wouldn't grow. And they would shape their heads at a young age to try to make it long and cylindrical. And they would have tattoos all over their body. And they came in and they thought they were alien people. They didn't know they were of this world. The writings of these interactions with these people that they didn't even know existed up until all of a sudden they just show up on their border and they look like alien people because of all this disfigurement. And they come in and they are wiping them out. And so these Visigoths, these strong Germanic people, throw down their arms and run. And they run to Rome, and they say, please let us in your borders, protect us, we are getting destroyed out here. And they cross the Danube River, and the Romans let them in. They say, keep your weapons outside, you may come into our land. But the Romans have been fighting these people for years, for centuries, and they did not very much like them. And so they treated them terribly. And so now they let in these historical enemies of themselves within their own borders, and they're mingling, and they're co-marrying, but they never really like them. They never really treat them as full equals. And these Visigoths now within their own borders rise up, and eventually leading in 378 to the Battle of Adrianople, which is really considered the destruction and fall of the Roman Empire. It came at the hands of the Visigoths, who were only in the Roman Empire because Rome let them in, because they were afraid of these people on their eastern border. Now the Huns would come in, they would destroy Gaul, which was France, and then through Spain, and a lot through Africa. They were destroying a lot of the other parts of the Roman Empire, but the fall of Rome happened because these Germanic people that were pushed in there because they couldn't deal with it all on the border, that the Romans let them in. And so we have the fall of Rome in 378, and the end of this fourth and great Daniel 2 prophecy, this great empire. And that's the end of that prophecy, if you will. And we see how throughout all this time, these people have been shaping it and have been setting the course of history, because none of these four empires rose and fell just under their own accord. There was always this little group of people, this counterculture, this counter group of people that existed on the periphery that would set the stage. Because remember, God will raise up nations, God will raise up empires, but he will also bring them down. Now that prophecy ends there. We could go through, you know, we all know there are 10 reincarnations of the Holy Roman Empire that will culminate in the final conclusion of the prophetic sense. And these people of Gog and Magog really have had a part in a lot of that as well. So we saw after the fall of Adrianople, the second reincarnation of the Roman Empire will happen in 800 as Charlemagne is set up as king of the Holy Roman Empire, the first Holy Roman Emperor, and he's a German. And this is really, we see from 378 to 800 AD, how we start to see, as we see from a prophetic sense, that Rome stops being Italian because of that German influence they brought in, and it eventually shows up after these dark ages where there's very little history. And in 800, we see a German emperor set up as the Holy Roman Emperor in Charlemagne, who was crowned in the city of Aachen in 800. And that is how those Germanic people who are pushed in by Attila the Hun come in and change the idea of what Rome is from being an Italian, if you will, up into a German society. And it happens because of these people had set the stage. In 1095, the Seljuk Turks, which were another Gog and Magog steppe nomadic people, would come down and fight the Battle of Manzikert in the Byzantium Empire, just outside of Constantinople. and they would defeat the Holy Roman Empire at that time, which had been set up under Justinian so much that the leader of Constantinople would put a call out to the Pope and ask for help, thus starting the Crusades. Edward Gibbon, in his history of the Holy Roman Empire, says that this Battle of Manzikert, that once again was perpetrated where the Seljuk Turks sacked a large part of the people of Constantinople, really was the end of the Byzantium Empire as well, this Christian empire that was in the east, and it started the stage for the Crusades, and we know what history was shaped from that as well. We would come down, as we know, in 1258. At this point, Europe is not very strong. The true power on the world scene was the Muslim Empire, really based out of Baghdad. They were called the Achaemenid Empire, if you will, at the time. And they were so powerful from a science standpoint, from a religion standpoint. They were exerting power over all the world, and they were the ones who were doing everything. The Europeans at the stage were kind of wallowing in those dark ages, those medieval ages, not very strong. But all of a sudden, a great army from the north and from the east, out of this region, the steppe, a man named Genghis Khan. And then after he would die, his followers as well, Kublai Khan and some of his kids, would sweep into this land and destroy the city of Baghdad in 1258. Baghdad was the most powerful city in the world. It was one of the more populous cities in the entire world. And when Genghis Khan and his army came down and destroyed it, we read about it, the city of Baghdad would not regain its population until the mid-1950s from this city in 1258 when it was destroyed. Genghis Khan and then his sons who would come in and destroy it would destroy it, much like we read about those cities of Syria and Nineveh, the cities of Babylon, everybody, men, women, children, everybody would be wiped out. And when they did that and they swept through and they destroyed the whole Islamic territory at this time, that set the stage then, because a lot of those scientific people then would flee and they would go up through Constantinople and they would travel into Europe. And that really set the stage for the beginning of the Renaissance and for the rise of Christendom, if you will, because Christendom couldn't really rise and get the area of the Gutenberg Bible, which allowed for the spread of God's word, for the time of the Reformation, which would see the change in evangelical and Protestantism, and the spread of Christianity couldn't happen until they became out from under the yoke of these Islamic powers. They weren't strong enough to destroy them. Once again, it took one of these armies from the north. Genghis Khan is an interesting one if you ever read about him. He, once again, we're now in the 1200s, and there's only one book that was written by the great Khan, one of the great empires that ever ruled and great conquerors. We don't have a lot of history about them, but at one point in history, they are fighting a war against samurais in Japan and Christian warriors in Hungary and Poland at the exact same time, and they're conquering everything else in between. And neither side on either end even knows the other exists. That's how great his empire was when it was battling at its time. And he came through and wiped out all those that they never quite got into Europe, because every time they would get really close and they were destroying Europeans whenever they fought them, but then the Khan would die and everyone would just go home. Because they're like, well, he's dead. That was his battle. They'd just leave. And so Christendom was spared as the Islamic societies were destroyed, and we see setting the stage for the great rise that we see with the Reformation and the Renaissance that allowed a lot of the history that we see about now. Even out into the modern world, Napoleon in 1812 sets out his great conquering of Europe, and he makes the classic mistake that many have done, that Hitler would make in the next generation. Both of these are reincarnations of the Holy Roman Empire. They would do what even the Princess Bride tells us to not do. You don't get involved in a land war in Asia. Even the Princess Bride understands this concept, and we've known about it. It's prophetic. And he would do the same thing. He would move into the same region of the steppe, and he would face what everyone else did. They'd just move. You read about Napoleon's march through winter, and the Russians would just move back. There's even stories of Napoleon's, of the French, saying when they would come into battle here, there were a group of people that showed up with bows and arrows on horses, wearing a little bit of chainmail. And this is an era of gunpowder and cannons, and these same people that would show up to the same battle, but they just moved away. And the further and further Napoleon got in, he'd face the same problem and couldn't extend his supply lines. Hitler would do the same thing in 1941, as he would try to do the same thing and run into the same era. Anybody, and through all these incarnations, who tried to go about coming into this region and facing these people would always face the same ending. This was a great and mighty army that has always existed that just most of us don't even know about, but they have shaped the course of history from the book of Daniel to all those, to a lot of the reincarnations of the Holy Roman Empire that we see even throughout the modern time. But then they would just go away. And so that brings us down to the future, so that we see where they have kind of played a role in the past. But the Lord, however, is a God of justice. And while the first 6,000 years of human history were dominated by man, and we're shaped by man's course of history, Christ is going to return. And he is going to set a new stage. And so the nations that were set up and brought down by God's will many times their hands, Christ will be returning, though, and he's going to change that culture. No longer after 6,000 years or so will we have the age of man. We are going to lead into now the age of God after his return. And so we have in Ezekiel chapter 38 and 39 this very large prophecy that is, once again, about this people, these people of Gog and Magog, that looks, gives us a little bit of a look. Because as we transition into the time ruled by Christ, we're going to see that the largest prophecy about them is here in Ezekiel 39. And the stage that we're going to see here, this prophecy in Ezekiel 38 and 39 is soon after the millennium starts, soon after Christ's return. We're looking at the early stage. You know, the Battle of Armageddon has happened, and I can only imagine that people are afraid, that people are confused. You know, we like to look at the millennial reign and what it's going to be like in this new age of God, but it's still going to be dealing with human beings. There's still going to have to be an education that has to happen. There's still going to have to be a change of culture. It won't just happen like that. And so we'll see now that this army who has always been shaping history, these group of people who have been on the periphery cultivating and changing things are, God is still going to use them in the future. But we have to see that people are still going to learn. Let's set the stage before we go to Ezekiel. Let's go to Isaiah 2. Let's go over here and we'll see a little bit of what it's going to be like. You know, this Isaiah 2, verse 2, this is a hymn we sing that we know about. And it says, "Now it will come to pass in the latter days," Isaiah 2:2, "that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established on the top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills. And all nations shall flow to it. Many people shall come and say, 'Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways. We will walk in his paths. Out of Zion shall go forth the law.'" These people are going to have to learn. It's not that Christ is going to return and the Battle of Armageddon will happen and this new era will start and everyone will be like, "Oh, now I get it. Law and the prophets. I got it all." You know, all these people who had never been exposed. No, they will go. So let us go up. Let us learn. Let's go up to the mountain of the Lord so we can learn about his ways so the law can go out. Zechariah 14, verses 16 through 19 tells us the story that we look at many times during the feast, where it says that if nations don't go up to Jerusalem, they will not get rain. It says specifically Egypt, if they don't come up, will not get rain. That's telling us there are people who won't truly understand. There will be people who don't buy in. There are going to be people who have to learn. This is going to be a process. So we see here at the start of the millennial reign, after Satan is put away, there's going to be a process by which having to teach these people. And so now we go to Ezekiel 38. That's our stage, because this prophecy is dealing with the very early phase of God's millennial reign, or after Christ has returned. And we see what will happen. Ezekiel chapter 38. And we're going to bounce around through Ezekiel 38 and 39 here. We'll read a portion here. In verse 4, it starts out, it says, "I will turn you around and put hooks in your jaws, and lead you," verse 2 says this is, "you know, set your face against Gog and Magog, the prince of Rosh," and it comes down to verse 4, "I'll turn you around and put hooks in your jaws and lead you out with all my army, horses and horsemen, all splendidly clothed, a great company with bucklers and shields and all handling swords." So we're seeing here God is drawing this army. God is going to be leading them. He's saying, "This is Gog and Magog, I will take you." So he is the one who is instigating this process. Verse 8, if we come down, it says, "And after many days you will be visited in the latter years, that you will come to the land of those brought you back by the sword and gathered from many people on the mountains of Israel, which had long been desolate. They were brought out of the nations and out from dwell safely." This is Israel is being brought back into the Holy Land. In verse 9, "You will ascend coming like a storm," saying about Gog and Magog, "covering the land like a cloud, you with all of your troops and many people." So they're coming down and will surround the Holy Land. And we come down in verse 18. It says, "And it will come to pass at that time when Gog comes against the land of Israel, says the Lord God, that my fury will be on my face." Verse 21, "I will call for a sword against Gog throughout all of my mountains, says the Lord God. Every man's sword will be against his brother. And I will bring him to judgment with the pestilence and bloodshed. I will rain down on him and on his troops and on the many peoples who are with him, flooding rain, great hailstones, fire, and brimstone. Thus I will magnify myself and sanctify myself, and I will be known in the eyes of the nations. Then they shall know that I am the Lord." So God is going to bring this army, this Gog and Magog, this great many people from the north and from the east, and he's going to bring them down against all his people that he gathered back together in the land of Israel, and he's going to bring them against Israel. And you can imagine if you're these people sitting here and you've known throughout history, whenever this army comes down, bad things happen. I can imagine there's going to be fear. There's going to be trembling. They're going to recognize what this army is. And as they come there, God is going to destroy them utterly himself. The people won't have to raise up a hand. And they're going to do it right in front of them. And so all those people who are gathered together in Israel are going to see this mighty army brought down, and then God will destroy them from above. And verse 22 says that he will do it so that they shall know that I am the Lord. That is their justice. And it begins to tell us that how he will magnify himself and his nations. He's going to destroy them right in front of all these people so they begin to see. The purpose of this prophecy, I believe, is two things. And what is going to happen in this scene where he brings them down for all to see that he will destroy them? There are two reasons for this. The first, let's go over to chapter 39 and verse 22, because he will tell us himself why he does this. In chapter 39 of Ezekiel, in verse 22, it says, "So the house of Israel shall know that I, the Lord their God, from that day forward." First reason for this destruction is that Israel will know that he is the Lord. Remember those reasons I told you about before of why the book of Daniel and that prophecy in Daniel 2 was given? The second reason I said was that the people would understand that God still has a purpose for them and that he has a plan and he will be a redeeming factor for them. And now he will gather them back together. He will finally, after all those years in captivity, all those years of being spread out in their diaspora, he will bring them back to their land. And then that great evil empire that had been perpetrating, you know, throughout this region will be put in front of them, and he will destroy them so that those people will know. So Israel will remember that he is the Lord. Throughout time, whenever the armies of the steppe came sweeping down like a force like this, it usually resulted in utter destruction. If we see here, we're in verse 39, or chapter 39, let's drop down to verse 25. It says, "Therefore, thus says the Lord God, now I will bring back the captives of Jacob and have mercy on the whole house of Israel, and I will be jealous for my holy name. And after they were born, their shame and all their unfaithfulness in which they were unfaithful to me, when they were dwelt safely in their own land and no one made them afraid, when I have brought them back from the peoples and gathered them out from their enemies' lands, and I am hallowed in their sight of many nations, then they shall know that I am the Lord, their God, who sent them into captivity among the nations, but also brought them back to their land and left none of them captive any longer. And I will not hide my face from them anymore, for I shall have poured out my spirit on the house of Israel. Thus says the Lord our God." God brought them back and granted them safety. And he, doing so, he destroyed the mightiest army at the time right in front of them, and they didn't even have to lift a finger. An army that had plagued them for centuries and for many generations. God is showing that he is in control. He can bring an army to bear, and he can destroy it. And he is the one, and he's setting the stage for people to realize, now we're starting a new age. This army that had always been a force of destruction, now I will take care, I will destroy them, and I will be your protector. I have brought you home, even when you took you away because of your infidelity, but now I have brought you back, and I have taken away this ancient enemy, and now you will know that I am your God, and I'm time to bring you back into the fold. So the first reason is so that the people of Israel will know and be brought back that God is still their God. The second reason, if we go back into verse 21, that this prophecy of what happens to Gog and Magog. Verse 21 of chapter 39. It says, "I will set my glory among the nations. All the nations shall see my judgment, which I have executed, and my hand, which I have laid on them." Verse 22, we just read a little bit before, where it says, "I do this for the nation of Israel." Verse 23, "The Gentiles shall know that the house of Israel went into captivity for their iniquity, because they were unfaithful to me. Therefore I hid my face from them. I gave them into the hand of their enemies, and they fell by the sword." First, he wanted the Israelites to know that he is their God. The second reason for this prophecy is so that the Gentiles would know as well. We're talking about a new age of man, and now the Gentiles know. See, these were my people. I had sent them away, but now I have brought them back. But now you too, Gentiles, you are now also getting the same chance. You also can know that I am the Lord. And it's a sign for them as well. Early parts of chapter 39 show in detail the large-scale activity that would take place to cleanse this battlefield. It would take over 7 months after this army is destroyed in front of all of them for all the people to be buried, and everybody will have to participate in the process. It's going to be a very real, a very tangible, and they will be able to smell it, and it'll take them 7 months, every one of them, to bury the dead. Everybody will see what had happened and the power that God has. And the Gentiles will begin to realize this is the God who rules. And they've already seen, you know, Christ had returned, but there's still going to be people who need to learn, and this is going to be a tangible lesson for them to understand who and what God is. This is to be a large-scale demonstration of who is in control of this new age. Because before it had been an age of man, but now it is going to be an age of God. And now Satan is off the scene, and people are going to understand what is going on, and it's going to set the stage so that they can learn. that scripture we saw in Isaiah and in Jeremiah, where people now are going to want to learn. They're going to see the power of God, and this destruction of Gog and Magog at this point is going to set the stage so that they were going to want to. The Gentiles will see the majesty and the power of God while the Israelites are being reintroduced to the God they had turned their back on so long before. And they're all going to be able to realize and begin to follow him. Chapters 40 through 48 of Ezekiel, after this prophecy, begin to talk about the restoration of the temple, followed by the restoration of the city Jerusalem, followed by the restoration of the Holy Land itself. But none of that can take place until these people are given a tangible lesson of who God is, and now they're going to want to. And then the whole process of restoration, that whole vision that we look forward to in the fall holy days, with the Feast of Tabernacles, Last Great Day, and looking through that millennial reign, it is going to be this destruction of these people at this phase. It's really going to set up this thousand-year reign where people are now going to want to go through the times of restoration, like we read about in the book of Acts, and rebuild the temple, and rebuild the Holy Land, and rebuild the city of Jerusalem. Both the Gentiles as well as the Israelites are going to want to come in because they'll see now God's power and are ready to get on board. And so we'll go through the time of the millennium. And we'll come then to the end. And once again, Satan will be released. And we'll see that final installment of the story that we read about, and the final judgment of Satan and Gog and Magog when they are destroyed by fire, as we come down then to Revelation chapter 20, when Satan is once again released back out. But we've seen from the beginning of history, when God shows that he would intervene and direct the course of nations, that the people of God and Magog were an instrument that did that. And they helped shape the course of nations. They helped rise up, and they were judged, and then they were brought down. And when the culmination of history happens here in Revelation chapter 20, it's going to come to a point where God's going to be in full return of his new heavens and his new earth, and he's really going to be setting the stage. And we'll see once again there an instrument of God's judgment that are no longer going to be needed. Because as we've seen, Gog and Magog in the first 6,000 years were his weapons of indignation. That was Isaiah chapter 13, verse 5 we saw, and that's what he called the Medes. These people of the steppe, this army of Gog and Magog, were his weapons of indignation that he would bring upon the scene to cause destruction when he judged the course of history, to set it up and to bring it down. During the millennial period, this army of Gog and Magog were still a mighty army, but one whose destruction would act as a sign of who God is and what his power would be, and showing that Israel, that he was still their God, and then also, though, to the people and the Gentiles who were still learning that he was the powerful one who was setting the course of history here. And now we'd come into a new age where man was no longer in control. And with the coming of the new heavens and the new earth, Gog and Magog are no longer going to be needed. Their purposes will no longer be there. God is going to send fire from heaven to destroy this instrument so that the people can move forward. No longer will there be this need for this army. And that's what's so great about the scripture. When we come down to Revelation chapter 20, and we rightfully so always focus on the destruction of Satan and his final removal as an instrument of destruction that has always been there. But we shouldn't neglect the fact that this army, this Gog and Magog army, are also destroyed as well. And what God is saying is, I don't need them anymore. I don't need my weapons of indignation. They no longer serve a purpose for me. I don't need to set the course of human history and set up and take down nations. I don't need to show and destroy them so that people will understand who I am. Everybody will know now. They no longer serve a purpose. And their destruction is just as beautiful of a scene as we come down in Revelation 20, verse 8 and 9, that he no longer needs these people, these cruel people, these evil warriors that have always been used as an instrument, but now they're no longer needed. And so from the very beginning, Gog and Magog have had one purpose throughout all of this, going all the way back to the times of the kings. And that is to point people to look and see that they shall know that I am the Lord.